Well, hello, everybody. I'm Chris. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Chris.
A lot of people here. I get nervous in front of big crowds. I've been told to picture everybody naked. So if I stare at you, you'll know why. So first, let me say that I want to thank the Georgia State Service Assembly for inviting me, particularly Tracy. Thank you very much for inviting me. It's great to be here. Also, I want to thank Tom and Mark, who've been my companions all weekend. They picked me up at the Atlanta airport and indulged me and brought me to see the Allman Brothers gravesite and had a great time together on Friday. So thank you guys very much. Let's see. I got sober on May 21st, 1989, at the NYU group in New York City. Don't hold that against me. But I was, me myself, I'm not a real big drinker. You know, I like to have one or two, but when I have one or two, I turn into a different person, and that guy really likes to drink. So anyway. All right, so let me tell you about myself. I got a lot of time here. I got to fill it. So I'm going to start at the beginning. I was born into an alcoholic home. My dad was a really wonderful guy, but when he drank, he was a terror. He was angry. He was violent. The police used to have to come to the house and arrest him and take him away. It was sort of like, when I was a little kid, it was like an episode of Cops in our house. A lot of the, you know, not every night, but, you know, six times a year, which is enough to traumatize a kid, you know. And I spent a lot of time in school and that sort of thing, nervous about whether my father would come home drunk that night or not and what would happen. And I was distracted, and I went to a Catholic school, and we had these Franciscan nuns who were not very tolerant. And I was in trouble a lot because I was distracted a lot, and I was told that I was lazy, that I was good for nothing, and I started to believe all that, you know, and I began to isolate. I began to pretend I was sick and not go to school or skip school, all that kind of stuff. I really had a rough time as a kid trying to avoid the anxiety that I felt and the pain that I felt, and I had a rough time. That it went pretty much like that through grade school. After fifth grade, the Catholic school actually asked my parents to take me out of the school. And so I went to public school starting in sixth grade, and it really didn't change much, except at that point in my life, 12, 13, I discovered alcohol. Now, you would think that somebody who had grown up in a home where he saw what alcohol did, but I saw what it did to my father. It turned him into a monster. And yet I was fascinated by it. I mean, you know, we would go to these neighborhood parties, you know, the people that my father hung out with, my mother and father hung out with, like, had keg parties, you know, so it's like, and we used to go to those, and I would watch the men. All these guys were like World War II vets, and they were sort of like angry during the day and during the week and not too friendly, and then all of a sudden they became friendly, you know, at these parties and stuff. And so I was fascinated by what this alcohol did, you know. And so when I was 10 years old, it was the first time I got drunk. It was at my older sister's wedding. She was 12 years older than me. And it was a big wedding, probably, you know, 150 people or something like that. And there were a couple tables of the friends of my sister and her husband. And I went over to them and I would say, could I have a sip? 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 And I went around both tables, you know, so 20 sips for a 10-year-old kid. And some of them were gulps, actually. And I got really drunk. They had to be carried out and taken home and put on the couch. And, you know, not much changed after that with my drinking. I mean, that's pretty much the way I drank. You know, I hear friends of mine who talk about the progression of their disease, you know, that when they were, you know, they went to parties and stuff and then maybe got a little tipsy and then alcoholism progressed in their lives until at 35 they realized they were an alcoholic. It wasn't like that for me. I was a blackout drinker from the very beginning, and I couldn't get enough of it, and you know, I would do things like steal money from my mother to get alcohol, steal money from my grandmother to get alcohol. The way I drank was, there's a line in a Grateful Dead song called Shakedown Street. It says, maybe you had too much too fast. And that's pretty much how I drank, too much too fast. Passing out and all that, blacking out, getting in trouble with the law. One of the worst things I did was get a license and start driving. Had several accidents. Somehow I never, maybe it was the time, never got in trouble for it. Never got in trouble with the law, but, you know, wrecked a couple cars. Trouble with my family. You know, I tried to find ways to be able to drink, but not get drunk so fast and pass out, you know. So I would try things like drink rum and Coke. And I would have one rum and Coke, and then one Coke, and then one rum and Coke, and then one Coke. I ended up drinking just as much, but with all that sugar. Can you imagine the hangover the next day? I was like, oh. So that didn't work. And then I tried various pills that helped you to stay awake. And that just got me just as drunk, but wide awake and not really doing too well. And then I would actually leave a bar and go around the back and throw up so I could drink more. I mean, how insane is this? This is insanity. And that's how I drank. And it took me 5 years to get through high school. I failed a lot of classes. I squeaked out. They kind of gave me a gift diploma just to get rid of me, because I was almost 20 years old when I graduated from high school. And all of my friends were moving on with their lives. A couple guys went into the military. Most of my friends were going on to college. My grades were such that I couldn't do that. I never made it to the SAT, you know, to take the test. It wasn't in the cards for me. One weekend, it was actually a Tuesday, it wasn't a weekend. It was my weekend. I had Tuesdays off at the job I had. I worked at a marina in Ossining, and my basic job was to lay on my back and scrape the bottom of boats and repaint them with that blue paint that the barnacles fall off of. And it's a miserable job. I mean, if you could imagine laying on your back, 95 degrees with goggles, long sleeves, a bandana on your hair, a mask. I was an early user of the mask, and trying to keep the paint chips out of your nose and out of your mouth and out of your ears and all that, and in out of your eyes, and still getting it in your everything with a hangover. It was a pretty miserable existence. So anyway, this Monday night, I went to the bar with friends. I had Tuesdays off from the marina, and we were going to go down to Jones Beach in New York. So we packed the car with coolers and beer and sandwiches and all that, drank all night until 4 a.m. The bars close at 4 a.m. in New York. And took off for Jones Beach, got there about 5:30 a.m., drank, passed out on the beach. I don't know, you can see my skin. It's kind of freckly, you know, very light Irish skin. And, I had this giant boom box. You know what a boom box is here in Georgia? And it was silver. And it was next to me. And I was passed out on the beach with the music playing with the silver, and the sun came up. And it reflected off the boom box onto me. So this side of my body got, you know, first degree burns, and this side of my body got second degree burns. And I was burnt to a crisp. And I got home, and next day I woke up, and it was literally, I don't know, some of you are too young for this, but there was a episode of I Love Lucy where she gets a sunburn, and that's what I was doing. I was trying to walk to the bathroom like this. So that no piece of my skin would touch another piece of my skin, because it hurt too much. Luckily, my back was okay. So I laid on my back for 3 days, and a couple things happened. I detoxed, and I had a very limited kind of spiritual awakening, meaning that I made the connection that my life was very screwed up and that alcohol was a big part of that. So I was 20 years old. It was June of 1978, and I quit drinking, and I really did. I quit drinking for 8 years, and my whole life kind of changed. I took up running. I got in shape. Suddenly girls were interested in me, because I wasn't passed out, and I actually started dating like the girl that I had a crush on my whole high school time and everything, and she was a very good student. So I figured out a strategy. There was a community college in Westchester where I lived, and if you had a high school diploma, you could go there. It was open enrollment. So I went, and the first semester was kind of remedial reading and remedial math and all that. And got my grades up, continued, made it to the president's list of the school, and transferred out of there and went to Syracuse University. And they were 3-0 in football. They beat Purdue today. I couldn't believe it. That hasn't happened in decades. But anyway, excuse me. Did really well. Was in love, doing well in life, not drinking. And everything started to fall into place. And I got through school. And I got a job at a magazine when I got out. And things were going good. This young woman and I got married, got an apartment in New York City, and I was living the dream. Unfortunately, I was a dry drunk, and I was a workaholic, and I was quick-tempered, and I didn't have much else going on in my life besides my work and my relationship, and my relationship started to not go the way I wanted it to, and we drifted apart. And she had an affair, and I caught them in the apartment together. And I kept my cool, but it ripped my heart out. And the next day, I was out drinking. And I drank, and I did everything else I could get my hands on for 2 years. And one night, I was heading for the Queensboro Bridge because I was going to jump off. I was in incredible pain. My heart was broken. I was back to drinking. I thought, I didn't have this program. I didn't have any friends who knew about alcoholism. I thought I quit for 8 years. If I drink tonight, I can just stop again tomorrow. And then when I drank that day, well, I quit for 8 years. I could stop tomorrow. I couldn't stop. It was way worse. I mean, my drinking was terrible. I was a binge drinker. I was a blackout drinker in high school. But now I was all that, plus I had to drink every day. One thing I have to catch up on is that while I was married, I started grad school. Excuse me. It's more remembering this stuff that's drying me out than anything, but I'd started grad school for magazine journalism. And I was doing really well in it, and then this happened, and all of a sudden I wasn't doing so well in it, and I actually dropped out for a while. And during those 2 years, the first 18 months or so, I didn't do anything with grad school. I didn't go back. But I re-enrolled, and it was a good thing I did, because what happened was I was still having the problem with the alcohol, but I started to try to do the schoolwork again. And there was a student newspaper at NYU where I was going to school, and it had a little ad on the back page every week, and it said AA meets every Monday at 12:30 p.m. room 413 in the student center. And that's all it said. And I saw that. I was also in therapy because I was suicidal, and I thought therapy might be something I should do. My therapist, much to his credit, said that he wasn't qualified to diagnose alcoholism. He wasn't a medical doctor; he was a therapist. But I was talking about myself. He said, "You know, you think you're an alcoholic." And I've never met anybody who thought they were an alcoholic who wasn't an alcoholic, you know? And if you are an alcoholic, we're not going to be able to do anything about that here. You'll have to go to AA. And so I drank for another 6 months and kept seeing that ad in the back of the student newspaper. And I had a particularly bad weekend. I had gone out with this young woman for a couple months, and we went out, and I promised myself that it would be different this time. I would just have a couple, you know, I wouldn't get drunk. I'm just going to have a couple drinks to take the edge off, and I would be fine. And the next morning, she wasn't there, and I didn't remember what happened. And I called her, and she told me never call her again. And that was after a Friday night on a Saturday. And I think I actually went out drinking that night again. But on Sunday, another thing started to happen to me that happened that Sunday. I would go to bed. Like on a Sunday, I might not drink on Sunday, and I would go to bed, and I couldn't close my eyes, because if I closed my eyes, I'd start seeing visions of, like, scary faces and rats and things like that. And so the next morning, after a night of that, I worked on Lower Fifth Avenue in Manhattan, and the school was about 7 blocks down across Washington Square Park to get to the student center where the meeting was. And I left work at 12 to go to the meeting, and I got, you know, to 16th Street and was going to turn around and go back to work, and then I really kept going. And I remember, like, getting to a no, don't walk sign. I was going to turn around and go back, but I kept going. And I finally walked in, and you had to actually tell the guard where you were going. And luckily, I remembered room 413, so I didn't have to say, where's the AA meeting? I just said, I'm going to room 413. He said, okay, good. And he knew what that was. And I got off the elevator. I was a minute or so late. I mean, I was kind of hesitant to get there, you know. and I walked in, and I opened the door. It pulled out. It was a solid door with just like a little window about that big. So I kind of looked in. I saw there were people in there, but I couldn't see. I got in, and it was just a table about, you know, like this big, with seats around it. So it was probably 12 or 15 people around the table, and there was an open seat. And I sat down, and there was a guy there who had grown up in an Irish Catholic family. He had a father who was a drunk, who was a sweet guy most of the time, but when he drank, he was a terror. He talked about how much fear he had in his life and how much hopelessness and how he always was afraid to be around people. And I started to identify with him right away. And this guy was like, he was really handsome. He looked kind of like... He kind of looked like an Irish Elvis, you know. He had hair that was slicked back, and handsome kid, and a little older than me, but somebody I could admire. And then he just talked about AA and how it had changed his life, and how he only had 2 years, but to me that was an eternity, you know. And so it went around the room after he shared, and people shared, and. Everybody said, hi, I'm so-and-so, and I'm an alcoholic. And it got to me, and I knew I was. And there was no doubt in my mind. And I said, hi, I'm Chris. I'm an alcoholic. This is the first time I've ever been in an AA meeting. I need help. And four people came up after the meeting to me, including Chuck. And Chuck handed me a big book, a living sober, and a meeting guide. And I don't even know if they print these anymore, but the New York meeting guide used to be like a little phone book, you know? I mean, page after page after page of meetings in Manhattan, Queens, Brooklyn, Bronx, everywhere. Westchester County, where I lived. And so I also got numbers. They gave me a little card. It had the Serenity Prayer on it. I think it had the preamble on it, the 12 steps, and then inside there was spots for people to put their number, you know. And so I took their numbers, and I actually called Chuck that day, and he was really, really helpful to me. And he became my sponsor. And they told me to do a few things. They told me that I should... Whether I believe or not, whether I want to or not, every morning I should pray to God that he help me not to drink that day. And then I should call my sponsor. And then I should go to a meeting. And then I should read some AA literature. And then I should pray at night and thank God for keeping me sober that day. And I started to do those things. And little by little, the fear and the hopelessness started to subside. It wasn't gone, but it started to subside. I started finding meetings that I liked. I worked in the city. The NYU group only met it. They only met one time a week then, Mondays at 12:30. Now they meet 3 times a day, 5 days a week, and it's huge. But back then it was little. But I started going places like Perry Street, which is an infamous meeting in New York, because it wasn't far from where I worked. And the Perry Street was kind of a cool story because my boss Kathy O. something. Kathy O. lived in the West Village. And I asked her, how do I get to Perry Street? And Perry Street, there's only one reason to go to Perry Street for AA. And she said, Perry Street, eh? So I found out that she was in AA too. And she said, she patted me on the back and she said, okay, all is forgiven. Go to the meeting, you know? So that was cool. So I did. And I started finding other meetings that I liked in the city. And then nights and weekends, I started going in Westchester Saturday morning. I found this great meeting on Saturday mornings I used to go to. Slowly but surely, my life really started to change. You know, I started being able to get up in the morning. I started taking better care of myself. I started to be open to do things again. I started getting into my job again and all that. But I really had a great relationship with Chuck, my sponsor. And for the first couple of years, on those Mondays, he would meet me out front of my building. We'd walk and talk, and then we'd go to the meeting, and then we'd walk and talk back. You know, and that was those were special times for me. So now I'm sober, a year sober. And that's why I want to relay a message that this program works. I had tragedy in my life as a dry drunk, and it put me out drinking, right? Now, with a year sober, the house I live in, my parents' house, my wife and I had split up. They were away, and I was away, and there was a young woman who was watching their dog. And she and her boyfriend were having a fight in the house. She was staying at the house to watch the dog. And he went outside, and he took the gasoline for the lawnmower and poured it on the porch and lit the house on fire and destroyed the house. And I was incredibly angry about that and devastated, really. But I was standing in the driveway looking at this after the fireman had put it out. And up the hill comes Brian. And Brian is my AA buddy. And he heard that this happened, and he showed up. And then the next day, this guy Harry, another AA friend, came. And he helped me sort through whatever was left in the house to try to salvage, you know. And so rather than it putting me back out drinking, it just solidified my faith in the program, and in particular my faith in the fellowship, you know. And Chuck was there for me every day during this. And the worst part of that story I didn't include. The dog was killed. That was my dog, you know, so the dog was killed. So that really pissed me off. But that took a year to fix, put the house back up, and I stuck with my parents. You know, I helped them. I got an apartment, actually, and they were staying with my sister. And, you know, I helped my parents through all that and everything. And then a year later, my brother, who was living in New York City, came home and announced to the family that he had AIDS and he was very sick. And at that time, that was 1991, you know, they didn't have the medications back then. And so he moved back in with my parents, and we took care of him for a year. You know, the three of us, and my older sister too, and four of us, and slowly watched him deteriorate until he died in 1992. very dramatic, which was typical for my brother. He died on my parents' 50th wedding anniversary. Had to make a statement. Anyway, but I loved him, and he loved me, and it was tragic. But I went to meetings every day, and luckily at the NYU group, this was not something that was shied away from. If you had that kind of thing going on in your life, and you had the kind of pain that went along with that, you know, people were very, very, very supportive of people sharing about it, and it got me through that day after day after day. And so in the meantime, I met and fell in love with Gail, and Gail is still my wife. We've been married 31 years this year, and we've had two children. We have two children, and my daughter was born deaf, and my son was born with Asperger's syndrome, which is a mild form of autism. And I was beside myself in the 5 years after my son was born. Angry. I felt like I would look up at the sky and I would say, I was doing everything you wanted me to do. I was helping other people. I was staying sober. I was going to my meetings. WTF, you know. and not getting any answer, you know. And I'll admit this right here in front of all these people. I lost a lot of my faith in that moment, you know. I had had a spiritual awakening early on in my sobriety. I was coming up the Hudson River one night. My sponsor had me on the second step, and I read that part about the big book that said, do I now believe or am I willing to believe? And I put the book down and looked out the window, and the train going up the Hudson River, sun was going down, beautiful. And I thought to myself, who am I to say there's no God, you know? Yeah, I guess I'm willing. Yeah. And then all of a sudden, I had that, one of those Bill Wilson-type white light things going on, and it felt like the weight of the world was being taken off of my shoulders, and I had a hugely impactful awakening, and I really gained a lot, all my faith in that moment, and it really stayed with me a long time. But the challenges we had as parents with our two children, and the fear and the anger and the hurt that I felt, really started to chip away at that faith inside me. And I started to do all the wrong things. I started to not go to meetings as much. I stopped calling people. I started isolating. I started doing things that, you know, all the things I'd learned. Praying in the morning, reading the literature, no. Going to a meeting, no. Calling a sponsor, no. Praying at night, no. And I started to get depressed, and I started to feel hopeless, just like I did when I was a kid, you know. Luckily, this guy Artie from the Austin Scarborough group called me out of the blue and said they were having their anniversary meeting. Could I come and be the speaker? And I don't know what got into me, but I said, yeah, okay. All right. I'm not sure you want to hear me. But so I went there, and I basically told them what I just told you. Maybe it was a little more angry, because I was a little more angry back then. But I did try to make sure I stayed with the experience, the strength, and the hope. And at the end of the meeting, just like my first meeting, all these people came over to me and said, you know what, me too. That happened to me too. Right around the same time, when I had 15, 16 years, same thing started to happen to me. So in that moment, all of a sudden, I felt the connection again, you know. And not only to the fellowship, I couldn't believe it. I started to cry. That's just the way I'm built. I'm sort of built to think that I'm the only one. You know, I'm the only one that suffers this way. But then I realized, no, that's not true. So I actually joined the group that night, and I started going back, and was my time up? I didn't touch anything. I was getting to the best part. So, it's back? It's back. All right, so I signed up for that group, and I started going, and I started doing service. First, I started by leading meetings and doing outgoings. You know how outgoings are, right? They do that here, right? So, No? Okay, so outgoings. Every quarter of the year, there's a meeting in Westchester where they, all the groups come, not all of them, but a lot of them come, and we trade speakers, right? So, Austin Scarborough is going to go to the Briarcliff group, and Briarcliff's going to go to Croton, and Croton's going to come back to Austin Scarborough, and that kind of thing. So you have, like, on the nights you're not meeting, you're taking people out, and you're going speaking. And sometimes you bring the newcomers, you tell the newcomers to get in the car, you're coming, you know. And so I started doing outgoings, got connected with the guys again, you know, and things started to really turn around. And I reached like another crisis point, but I was well connected again. I worked at Reader's Digest, and Reader's Digest was on the, it's going over the cliff. And I was very worried about what was I going to do, you know. And all of a sudden I get a call. There was a designer who worked for me at Reader's Digest, who was now the designer of this little magazine here. And this guy, Greg Muth, who was the general manager at AA World Services, talked to my friend and said, you were in publishing. Do you know anybody that might want to be the publishing director at AA World Services? Because Vinnie M. had passed away that summer. And they needed somebody new. And so he called me, my friend called me, and said, this guy Greg is looking for somebody to do the publishing job. And I didn't know anything. You know, I knew about AA. I knew the big book. I knew the 12 and 12. I knew the pamphlets. But I had no idea whether that was, you know, a viable job for me or not. So I called Greg and did the interviews and all that and got offered the job, and they saved me, you know. AA saved me, and this was right around the same time that all this other crazy stuff was going on in my head. So I was working at AA World Services as the publishing director from 2002 to 2010. In the meantime, my daughter is going, with her parents' help, is going to therapy and is speech therapy and classes for the hearing impaired and all this stuff, and is doing really, really well. My son is still troublesome, but is... all of a sudden, like, he's a little kid, and he's all into computers, taking them apart and putting them together, and loves cars, wants a car. Every time we go to the store, he wants to get a car. you know. So now, 25 years later, because their parents were there for them and their father didn't drink and all that stuff, my daughter is a recruiter for a big hospital in New York, and my son is a technician at Tesla. So, so they're both doing really well. Both doing really well. And my, you know, my son, that's a good thing because they're going to have to take care of me when I get older, you know. So hopefully my son will have some money. But he's still quirky, but he's a great kid. So I got through that crisis. The only thing else, other thing I want to talk about is like the crazy spiritual journey of Chris Kavanaugh and how the hell I ever became the publisher of the Grapevine magazine, you know. So here I was having the DTs on a Sunday night, trying to get through grad school. I go to an AA meeting at NYU. I'm in school at NYU studying magazine journalism. I get sober in AA, and now I have this great job where I get to take the stories, people's stories, and put them in the magazine, put them on the podcast, put them on the website. In the near future, we'll be putting it all on an app, and there'll be room for more stories because it won't have the limits of the magazine. And all this great sharing, this experience, strength, and hope that's going out to people and helping, maybe helping somebody just get through the day without a drink, you know. And I get to do that now. And it started at that college, and, you know, I don't know which is more important. Let me take that back. The sobriety, what I learned in AA, way more important than the degree I got. Well, the degree helps, but I was I've been really blessed, you know. I'm sober 33 years. I have a wife who loves me. I have children who love me, and I love them. And we, you know, we have our issues, of course, but we, for the most part, we get along. The cops have never had to come to the house to take me away. My brother passed away. My parents are now gone. I guess the important thing I want to talk about, just to close, is that the, you know, I couldn't do it on my own. I was able to not drink for 8 years. True. But when the shit hit the fan, I went back to alcohol. But in sobriety, in AA, I've had a lot of tragedy in my life. What felt like tragedy. Some of it was the death of people, children who were not well, sickness. But the fellowship and the faith and the program and the hope that I got from a higher power and from the fellowship carried me through all that, you know. Like, carried me. And I want to close with a couple of quotes I saw yesterday. We went to see the Allman Brothers gravesides, right? And these were the epitaphs that were on. This is Barry Oakley. Barry Oakley was the bass player for the original Allman Brothers band. And this is the epitaph on there. Help thy brother's boat across, and lo, thine own has reached the shore. Right? That's very AA kind of thing. And then on Dwayne Allman. Dwayne Allman was a guitarist for the Allman Brothers band. I love being alive, and I will be the best man I possibly can. I will take love wherever I find it and offer it to everyone who will take it. Seek knowledge from those wiser and teach those who wish to learn from me. So those are, I mean, these are not guys that I don't think they were in AA. But the wisdom is stuff that I'll carry with me. And I took the pictures and I'm going to somehow put them up on my wall at work. So thank you all very much for listening. It's great to be here, and I really appreciate the Southern hospitality. Thank you very much.